This week we're headed to a tiny island in the Indian Ocean where a unique farm is growing food for local residents and helping them save on expensive grocery bills. We'll visit a dairy that's embracing tourism with a viewing area and cafe. You can sip your latte while the cows come in for milking. And we'll brave wasps and thorns for the native finger lime harvest and join the hunt for truffles in Tasmania.
We do a lot of nose down into the dirt, actually just smelling the dirt. So you're actually having just a sniff of the dirt saying, okay, can you pick up the aroma of the truffle in the ground? How strong is it? You're looking for a sharpness in the ground. It is a completely different type of aroma to just smelling dirt. Certainly at the peak of the season, you're walking up to a truffle and you go, there's a truffle there. You can just smell it in the air.
Yum, yum. Sniffing out gourmet delicacies, that's coming up. First, though, let's head to Christmas Island, where a grocery bag of fresh food will set you back an exorbitant amount. But a local man is hoping to change that with the island's first commercial food farm.
Walk into a supermarket on Christmas Island, a tiny Australian outpost in the Indian Ocean, and you can expect to pay $15 for a head of lettuce. A bag of shopping hits the hip pocket pretty hard.
We estimate it to be a plastic shopping bag. For each bag, you would guess at least $100. So you would estimate if you walked out of the shop with three plastic bags full of food, it would be at least $300.
Robin Stevenson is a schoolteacher on Christmas Island, and for years she and many others have managed to avoid paying a premium on fruit and veg by ordering in their own from Perth.
Where did your mum's stuff
from? That one, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, that one over there.
Hi, I'm Tom Joyner, and I'm here with Robin Stevenson and other locals who are gathered at the Christmas Island airport waiting for their groceries to arrive by plane. This happens every other Friday. It's a much anticipated event known as Freight Day.
You order it on a Tuesday and it gets here on the Friday, and it means you can choose what you want.
It's still really expensive. It costs Miss Stevenson almost $1,000 a fortnight, but it's what many are willing to pay. In fact, so prized is fresh food on Christmas Island that Robin Stevenson's own children consider vegetables like asparagus and broccoli a special treat.
Legra, don't be naughty.
Okay.
Don't be naughty. When we bring the freight box home, it's like, Mum, can I please have a whole apple right now, all to myself? And it's like, yes, because today's freight day.
Would you like a cherry?
Previous attempts to start up commercial farms on Christmas Island have failed, in part due to unsuitable soil and rugged terrain. The majority of the island is covered in dense rainforest. But an ambitious project started 4 years ago on a plot previously used for mining is hoping to reduce the island's reliance on freight.
I think there is definitely a demand on Christmas Island for locally grown produce. I think there's also a demand for a produce of a good quality that's at a good price. And one of the goals of what we're trying to do here is trying to marry those two.
Mark Bennett says after years of trial, error and hard work, the farm is already yielding a range of fresh produce, from eggplant all the way to passion fruit.
So if we get our objective right, then we hope that the community will definitely get to the stage where a lot of what they want to eat will be provided from what is grown on Christmas Island.
While many locals have chilies or limes growing in their gardens, no one on the island has ever before attempted, let alone succeeded, with something on the scale of this farm project.
Every one of us wants him to succeed, because even for myself, you know, that I run a restaurant, and whenever he's got the vegetables that we need, we'll take from him instead of bringing it in, that's for sure.
Ji Fu runs the popular Chinese Literary Association restaurant in the settlement neighbourhood of Christmas Island. She says she wants to see the farm expand even further.
If there's more land for farming and all that, why not? I think the locals will be very welcome to this sort of thing, you know.
The farm currently provides limited stock to shops on the island, but Robin Stevenson says it's not on the shelves for very long.
You'd have to like reserve your greens because people were very keen to have locally organic grown, you know, pesticide free, no carbon footprint or a smaller carbon footprint than flying it up.
The farm project is now working to increase supply so it can one day provide enough fresh produce to feed the entire island.
I think the flow-on effects for having locally grown produce is, well, that is affordable and at a good price, is that you have more people eating that, more people eating a diversity of good produce more regularly, and that has much better impacts on mental health and community health indicators such as diabetes and obesity, people become more active. You know, the studies have shown that the greater consumption rate of fresh produce, the more positive those flow-on effects are generally throughout the community. So that's something that is really one of the positive side effects of establishing something like this on scale, that we could also help export that idea or that concept to other remote communities which may have more significant, you know, community health issues than we do here.
So basically we just keep carting things and I go from one side to the next and just keep harvesting. We haven't managed to actually harvest all our rows yet. And it'll take a while before we actually get to the end of all of it.
Jade King is checking her finger lime bushes. These native fruit add a delicious citrus pop to salads, seafood, and even desserts. But the sharp thorn shrubs are a real pain to pick.
I suppose it's a bit like roses and things like that. If you prune them, they've got the thorns all the way down, so do these. And unlike pruning, you have to only do once a year. These harvests, you have to get right in there every harvest, and that's sort of constant at this stage.
And as well as the thorns, you also have to keep an eye out for wasps.
The other thing that I have to worry about is wasps, and I haven't checked this bush over before harvesting, so I don't want to find a wasp.
We'll both be running.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Nichols, and I'm here with Jade King in her orchard in a beautiful valley in the Sunshine Coast hinterland. And so far, it's been a really great season here.
We're really lucky. Our finger limes are actually growing earlier than most people's in the season. So we've already harvested over half a tonne of fruit this season. In the last month, we've done that, and then it will go right the way to June.
How many shrubs have you got planted here?
We have over 1,200 currently and another 800 going in. Production-wise, we're only harvesting off 350. Next year, we'll be harvesting off the 1,200. Then the following year after that, we'll get to the 2,000. So we mainly produce from the Champagne Red or Red Champagne variety. And I've isolated it just to that so that we can reduce the seed content within our fruit. Because one of the key things chefs told me is that they've opened up fruit and some of their first time jobs has been actually picking out the seeds. So we sort of decided, okay, we'll try something a little bit different and just go one variety, despite the fact that you're really excited to want to grow all these different colours. We just went champagne red.
Now, for people who've never seen a finger lime orchard, how would you describe it and describe the plants themselves?
Each orchard will be different. We plant them in rows and raised beds and we have irrigation to all of them. Each bush in itself, very dense and spikes on every terminal that comes out. And they don't just fruit once, they fruit and then they flower at the same time. So currently, like now,
you can hear the bees.
Yeah, we've got flowers, we're harvesting fruit. So those flowers will most likely come into fruition around about May. It's a constant battle of what am I looking after as in fertilising and watering and everything, because you've got every part of the physiology of the tree happening at once. So it's pretty amazing.
Jade King, you've been saying that pollination has been a real key here and also interplantings to reduce insects.
Yeah, so we don't use any insecticide, and how we go about that is we try and make sure we've got a different plants within our orchard. So we've got passion fruit. It's still productive. It's in the valley, so we've got that interaction between the bushland as well as our interplantings. Just this year we were really lucky to have some bee guide come out, and he's put out a whole heap of bees. We've both got Australian native and European. He pays us in honey. It's awesome. And the bees have increased the amount of pollination we've had in a big way. Last year we would have had probably 20% of our fruit come out deformed. We have had the bees in this year and it's amazing the turnaround that they've had. We've got increased fruit setting, greater yield, and we've had an increase in the actual formation of the fruit all the way through. So it's been incredible.
Where are you sending the fruit to?
We do all over Australia to the main markets, Melbourne, Perth, Sydney, Brisbane, obviously, and Suncoast Fresh
He distributes to our local restaurants, so that's really handy. It's nice to have someone that's local that represents us. And then we also export overseas. So we just did last week a load to Italy. We've done Singapore, we've got Hong Kong and Macau. So we're expanding that area. We've just got currently requests for some for China as well. So it's definitely growing and it's hard to keep up. But yeah, there are a lot of growers coming into it, and there's also some great established ones already. It's definitely sort of an industry that will hopefully grow.
But not at the price point where you end up having supply outstrip demand. That likely to happen soon, do you think?
Well, we're going into the main season, so price does drop, and you do question why you would put yourself through that torture of picking when the prices aren't that great. And I think, yes, the foreseeable future doesn't look amazing, especially with a lot of the overseas countries have now actually started growing them over there. And that will be a big issue because, especially, say, in Asia, they've got cheap labour. We don't. And so they'll be able to harvest really easily, whereas we're going to sort of struggle with that. So I think one of the best bits of advice I could give anyone that wants to start in them, come and harvest here first and tell me if you want to still. You're welcome anytime.
How many scars have you got?
I'm covered from basically where my gloves end upwards. Not fun.
How much are they selling for at the moment?
At the moment, we're looking at $35 to $40.
A kilogram?
Yeah, kg. It'll get down to 30 most likely. I believe I produce a great product and I won't go below 30 because then I'm not doing it for any profit. But out of season, because we're lucky enough to be where we are in this valley and we're warmer near the coast and everything like that, we get cropping all the way through the year. It just gets very, like, I suppose, less quantities from about July through to December, because we're one of the only ones that can supply during that time. Our prices go amazing then, and yeah, easily triple what the standard price is. So it's almost worth going through your whole orchard to find a finger lime.
Jade King from Green Valley Finger Limes on Queensland's Sunshine Coast. She's picking new season fruit and was speaking to Jennifer Nichols. You're with a Country Breakfast on RN. Still to come this morning, take a front row seat as the cows come in for milking at a high-tech robotic dairy. And let's join the summer truffle harvest in Tasmania.
When we find one in the ground, we tend to just have a little bit of a search around, just in case there's some more in the nest.
Crouched down on his hands and knees, Anthony Bratt has his nose to the ground. He's hoping to sniff out the distinctive aroma of truffle.
This is a trusty little truffle tool. You're moving away those loose impediments around it. You want to free up a certain amount of space. So in theory, if there was a truffle in this particular spot, you would be just moving that soil away from the outside to try and see where the perimeter of the truffle is. Checking the other favourite part of finding truffles. We do a lot of nose down into the dirt, actually just smelling the dirt. So you're actually having just a sniff of the dirt, saying, okay, can you pick up the aroma of the truffle in the ground? How strong is it? That's one of the keys there from a ripeness perspective with the truffle. If the ground has that aroma, you're probably searching in the right sort of area if you can't identify the truffle straight away.
What are you smelling?
At this point in time, I'm smelling dirt. Yeah, it is just purely dirt. But if there was a truffle there, you're looking for a sharpness in the ground. It is a completely different type of aroma to just smelling dirt, and you can identify it straight away. Quite often, certainly at the peak of the season, you're walking up to a truffle and you go, there's a truffle there. You can just smell it in the air.
Smelling the dirt is now all in the day's work for the former finance sector worker who's taken a career change to bring a neglected trufflery back to life. Hi, I'm Larissa Smith and I'm here with Anthony on Old Forest Vale Farm at Cressy in northern Tasmania. While truffle hunting has not proven a particularly profitable career so far, it has ignited a passion for Anthony in harvesting the pungent fungus for top chefs.
The ideal sort of truffle we want to produce is somewhere between a golf ball and a cricket ball. Chefs really like that size, really nice to shave onto the top of a dish. But they come in all shapes, sizes. They can be flat, they can be round, they can be quite knobbly as well.
So you're harvesting truffles in summer. That might seem a little unusual to people.
Yeah, it is. It's so the two different types of truffle simply are, you have that winter truffle, which a lot of people are going to be familiar with, and then you have the summer variety. Key difference between the two, summer truffle is a little bit more hazelnut colour inside, rougher on the exterior, different type of aroma. Your winter truffle is, when it's purely ripe, is black inside with a white vein, so you can determine the difference. Winter is where you make your money as a truffle grower, but summer, certainly, I think, are really good to use in just your general food production, and certainly chefs are finding it really attractive with your summery dishes.
Have you made money from your trufflery here?
Has it produced some money? Yes, it has. Are we a long way behind? Yes, we are.
And why is that? What's the story?
So when we bought the property 3.5 years ago, it had been fairly neglected, this area. So it's taken us 3 years of work to get it to actually to produce a truffle. Last season, we produced 3 truffles in total. With, if you look at a commercial value, we might have made $100. So we're a long way behind. This summer season has been quite successful for us. We seem to have found a key now. In a bit of a closed system, it's what we've done here, investing in better irrigation and just better, our knowledge has obviously improved as well.
You've been smelling a lot of soil.
We have. We spend a lot of time with nose in the ground. I walk through here every day to do it properly, 45 minutes to an hour, just as a quick sort of walk through, just looking for the signs. Okay, do we need to manage the irrigation a little bit different in this area? Are any irrigation lines broken? Sprinkler heads not working? Are there any truffles that are coming through the surface? Now that we're in that crossover type time period between summer and winter, are the signs there for the winter truffle as well as the summer?
Your background is in finance.
Very, very different. very different. I guess the one skill that overlaps a little bit is obviously from a business background. You understand that if you've got a truffery that produces $100 a year in income, you need to change something or you just don't do it. But it is a bit of a passion, and what I found, the more I've learned about that industry and the thrill that you get actually by taking a bag of truffles to a high caliber chef and see the joy they get out of using your own product, it's a great reward, and you don't get that in any other industry.
Driving to this dairy in the southwest, I had limited directions, limited reception, and honestly, if past experience of farmers' directions has anything to go by, I thought I'd probably miss it. But now I've seen this building, I realise there is no way that I could have. It's massive. 5,000 square metres and double storey, and it's entirely red with complex architectural twists and turns.
Yeah, the little red shed does stand out.
Do you want to have a look first?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Tyne Logan. I'm here with Sue Daubney, one of the managing directors of Bannister Downs, a milk processor and producer in Northcliffe, in the southwest of Western Australia. She's partnered with billionaire mining magnate Gina Reinhart to build this $20 million facility. It's a big investment for an industry that's been struggling in recent time.
It was this amazing dream, then it started becoming a reality, and those 2 years went so quickly. And every step of the way, it was about doing the best we possibly could.
One of the most unique aspects to the facility is its element of tourism. It's believed to be the first dairy in Australia to build in a viewing room and a cafe into its facility to entice the public to come and see for themselves what's going on.
Anyone that has had a sneak preview, we haven't actually opened for visitors yet, but we plan to very shortly, has just been blown away and just fascinated. And the way we've set it up is so people can have a really good look without impacting on what's going on. So it's safe for the cows, safe for the people. And there's also live feed up there, so you can actually see the robots, which is what everyone wants to see.
How much has tourism played into this whole design?
Tourism hasn't driven it. It's just been something, I guess, because we knew people would want to come and look. And it was an opportunity to give people confidence in our product because they could see every step of the way how we make it and how we prioritise hygiene and quality. And then by the time someone's driven all the way to Northcliffe, we thought they're bound to want a cup of coffee at the end of that. I mean, it'd be hard pushed to see anything negative out of it because the cows, it's obvious to see that they're happy and relaxed and doing what they do.
What percentage is that now going to become part of your income in this?
I think it's going to be at a cost. It's not. It's definitely not a driver on a business model. It's more about transparency, sharing with people the positives of our industry and the excitement in agriculture and the technology, and also giving people confidence in our product because they realise we're just a damn hard-working family business, and then they go away with a degree of loyalty, and that's what we hope to continue attracting and achieving.
Of course, with an investment of such scale, there is a lot of pressure on making sure that this facility brings growth and efficiencies to the business. Matt Daubney, who is Sue's husband and the other managing director of Bannister Downs, is the farm manager. And he runs the robotic rotational dairy that we're in now.
So basically, it actually has four robots. So the first two robots, like the first robot, if you like, will wash the back two teats. So wash and prepare the teats. The second robot washes and prepares the front two teats.
The dairy is the first of its kind in this state and one of only four in Australia. So there's a lot of eyes watching and waiting to see how it works.
I mean, when we sat down as a team on the farm, I said, look, this is not about replacing people. This is about making people more productive with the time they have. So the job like milking cows, right now we have to do that in some of our sheds because we don't have any other choice. But in the future, we can have robots milk the cows, which allows my farm team, if you like, are able to go off and do more productive things for this business. And I think that productivity gain is probably the real benefit.
There's also plans to increase the production significantly.
The biggest focus for us is the market growth of the product. And that's where also Mrs. Reinhardt and her team are very experienced, and they've got some beef, you know, that they're selling with her agricultural investments, and so I think there's some really good synergies there that we can work with. We export, and we have been for about 8 years now, to Singapore, just a very small shipment once a week. That's been a really good training ground for us because export is so challenging, and that's probably one of the easiest markets, and as a team we've learned a lot about that.
So how much do you plan on expanding your production, and in what kind of time frame?
Probably over the next 3 years we might triple, maybe four times what we're doing now.
So 20 million litres a year in the next 3 years.
Yeah, either that. Yeah, my hair might be very grey by then, but yeah, we're aiming for something like that.
Sue Daubney in the dairy at Bannister Downs in southwest Western Australia, and that report from Tyne Logan.